Hello and welcome back to a new look format for the Shepherd Defence podcast. Following a short hiatus, we're back with a regular look at some of the big themes in the world of defence. Each month you will hear from the news team, and the podcast will also feature stories from our partners, which are produced by Shepherd Studio. I'm your host, Ben Vogel, and I'm joined today by Shepherd's air editor, Tim Martin. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Ben.
And also our senior naval reporter, Harry Lai. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Ben. Good to be back.
Yes, welcome back to both of you. So for this episode, we're going to look into certain aspects of the ongoing war in Ukraine. Few defence analysts believed when the Russians invaded back in late February that the conflict would still be raging almost 3 months later, with well-motivated Ukrainian forces proving that they're a tough nut to crack, and Western military aid flooding into the country, as well as questions swirling around about the effectiveness of Russian equipment, tactics, and strategy. Indeed, it appears that Moscow moved away from Plan A to capture Kiev onto Plan B, old-fashioned attritional warfare with a strong reliance on artillery. So, Harry and Tim, we've got a lot to discuss, clearly. And, of course, we cannot see the true picture of what's going on in Ukraine and Russia. We can't understand everything that's happening. But perhaps I can start with you, Harry, because there are certain significant naval aspects to the war, even though the Ukrainian Navy barely exists anymore.
Yeah, it's certainly been an interesting one with a few high-profile incidents, to say the least, especially given that the naval domain has kind of been in the back seat compared to kind of air and land when it comes to this conflict. But some of these significant moments have really showed that even though Russia definitely has naval supremacy in the Black Sea, that the Ukrainians have been able to strike some pretty significant targets with the sinking of the Moskva and the Alligator-class landing ship Saratov, which both kind of naturally did the rounds on social media and the news for kind of the high-profile incidents they were.
And what of the development of Ukrainian anti-ship missile technology? We've reported in the past on moves to create an indigenous missile called Neptune. But was that actually used to sink the Moskva, as the Ukrainians claim?
So, as you say, as the Ukrainians claim, it was a pair of Neptune missiles that were used to sink the Moskva. I'm not sure kind of what the Russian line is at this point. They originally said that a fire had broke out on board the ship, and that it later kind of they were doing damage control and it later sunk. But at the very least, the Ukrainian claim is that it was these homegrown anti-ship missiles which were to blame. And it's quite significant given, as you mentioned, kind of this war being 3 months in, and at the time of the sinking of the Moskva, it was late into the conflict, that Ukraine still retained the ability to hold kind of such a prestigious naval vessel at risk.
And how have the Russians reacted, as far as we can tell from, obviously, as I say, we're speaking from a remove in relation to the conflict, but obviously the loss of the Moskva, as you say, was a big blow for the Black Sea Fleet.
It's definitely, at the very, very least, a propaganda coup for the Ukrainians, who naturally kind of cheered on what happened. One of the key aspects of the Moskva was its air defence capabilities, which I'm sure Tim's going to discuss quite a lot later on. Not the Moskva's air defence capabilities, but air defence in general, given how much it's been talked about. But the loss of the ship definitely has probably made it easier for Ukraine to kind of bring some of its air power to bear over the coastal areas. But that being said, there's still a lot of land-based air defence. So the sinking of the Moskva definitely has an impact, probably more from a propaganda perspective than anything else. But as you say, the thing is, obviously, it's a significant win for the Ukrainians that they kind of claim to have been able to do this. But Russia's still got around 20 vessels in the Black Sea, including submarines. So naval supremacy is still firmly in their hands, and Ukrainian towns and cities continue to be blockaded by what is a very, very strong Russian naval presence.
However, the Black Sea Fleet isn't quite as strong as it could have been, because Turkey blocked the Bosphorus, didn't it, in late February. How has that affected Russian tactics and strategy as far as you can see?
I think the most significant part about that and the Turkey closing the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles is that when there is a loss like that of the Moskva, it can't be replaced. So Russia cannot bring in new ships into the Black Sea to kind of fill the void of vessels that it has lost, which is naturally means that over time there's kind of, if there are more incidents kind of like that, the attritional effects will probably be more apparent. But that's the most significant thing, is that by closing those areas, Russia is unable to kind of backfill the capabilities it might lose in the region, unlike in, say, the land or the air domain, where you don't face that issue.
And we've been reporting a lot on various arms shipments from the West to Ukraine, shipments which indeed began even before the Russian invasion, when it was clear that Ukrainian territory was under threat. In the naval context, what kind of materiel has Ukraine demanded, and what kind of materiel has it received? And is there a kind of a mismatch between the two?
So anti-ship missiles was one of the high-profile areas that Ukraine requested, and the UK filled that void with the supply of Brimstone anti-ship missiles. Now, Brimstone as an anti-ship missile is not on the same league as, say, Harpoon or some kind of the larger weapons, which would do significant damage to a large surface combatant. Brimstone is probably best suited to striking smaller vessels and smaller targets. So even though, say, it might not have the hitting power of a large anti-ship cruise missile, the supply of the weapons alone means that Ukraine can hold at risk things like landing ships and some of these smaller ships that could potentially be used to harass kind of these coastal towns and ports that still remain in Ukrainian hands. So by supplying something like Brimstone, there's definitely a step up in defensive capability for Ukraine, to say the least. And one of the other interesting things has been the American decision to supply USVs. Now, it's still a bit kind of up in the air as to what these are. I haven't seen any reports specifically saying exactly what USVs the Americans are supplying, but it shows there's some very high-tech weaponry. And it's definitely a step above, say, the standard kind of ATGMs that we saw going in at the start of the conflict. The types of Western aid are definitely starting to get more complex.
Indeed, and noticing that in terms of the Ukrainian army receiving some pretty significant long-range artillery systems, 155mm howitzers, for instance, that have already been used to good effect on land. But just returning to the Black Sea, it's been pretty extensively mined. There have been effectively a number of incidents where merchant ships have either been blown up or damaged. I believe that's correct, isn't it, Harry? In terms of the impact for the Black Sea region, how the states bordering on the Black Sea are going to proceed in terms of guaranteeing security in that region. What hope is there for them to get involved?
That's an interesting one. Obviously, the closure of the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles also means that other NATO countries and other countries that aren't a Black Sea bordering state but have an interest in the region can't transit their vessels there either. So say if the British or the Americans wanted to send some kind of mine hunter in, that's not possible. So in terms of this mine threat, I think that's very much something that's going to potentially be a long-term headache and a long-term issue as these things kind of continue to turn up and arrive in places where they definitely shouldn't be, which, like you say, could cause more incidents that we've seen from the start with merchant vessels being hit or kind of being stuck in ports for long periods of time or not being able to leave Ukraine. There's definitely some long-term issues that it doesn't seem like there's an immediate solution to.
What about what's left of the Ukrainian coastline? In other words, Odessa seems to be the only port left in Ukrainian hands. Clearly, there's no prospect of Ukrainian surface vessels, at any rate, standing up to the Russian presence in the Black Sea. But there was a lot of speculation, some of it based on satellite imagery of landing ships approaching Odessa a couple of months ago, or even less, that the Russians would launch some kind of amphibious operation against that part of the Black Sea coast. As far as you're aware, has that threat pretty much abated?
I think that the supply of kind of new and more complex weapons would definitely make it even more risky to conduct an amphibious assault. I mean, an amphibious assault on a built-up area as it is already a risky option. And I don't think it's something that would have been taken lightly if the decision to do something like that would have been made. But definitely the supply of these new Brimstone missiles will probably make that calculation an even harder one to weigh up. But and it would be interesting to see kind of what these USVs offer as well in terms of kind of coastal defense capabilities, because that's kind of what the main mission set of what the US is supplying is. And then there's also the fact that it remains that it's kind of many, many months now into this conflict, Ukraine manages to still fly its TB2 drones, which have taken up a lot of the spotlight, as they kind of tend to do in many conflicts recently. And we've seen those be used to strike naval targets as well. So there's quite a range of threats that would make an amphibious assault of Odessa quite risky. And I think there's also the discussion of what the new objectives are. Obviously, as the months have gone on, kind of the objectives of Russia seem to have shifted. And so whether Odessa is still in its sights is a question that I personally don't have the answers to. And I don't know if many Western officials would either, given how kind of hard it is to get a read on what the kind of the Kremlin's decision making is.
Yeah, good luck to anyone who tries to get inside Putin's head at the best of times, let alone now. But you're mentioning the TB2, Harry, and it's very interesting, apparently, how the Ukrainian forces were able to use that platform to attack the Russians on the on Snake Island recently, as an example, and also how the TB2 has successfully managed to strike surface vessels.
Yeah, it certainly is, and one of our contributors wrote a really interesting piece, which I recommend our listeners go and find on the website. It's definitely worth the read, and it's significant in itself because it shows that surface vessels can be held at risk by UAVs, which is something that's not necessarily been apparent in other conflicts before, and not from least what I've seen. But it's definitely a significant development, and the kind of ongoing battle over Snake Island, as you say, has shown that these kind of there's more threats to surface vessels than just missiles and kind of conventional fires.
Yes, interesting. The naval dimension will continue to have some kind of effect as the conflict continues, for sure. Tim, I'd like to bring you in at this point, especially as we've just been talking about TB2, the Bayraktar. Now, it looks like the Snake Island attack and sinking Russian vessels with a drone just proves how difficult it's been for the Russians to establish air superiority, be it on land or at sea. So what's your reading of this? I mean, were you surprised in any way by the developments as they unfolded?
Yeah, I think so. I think very much so. I mean, initial analysis, and I'm going back to before the invasion began, was, or the kind of consensus among analysts was that if Russia could strike C4I infrastructure and use kind of land vehicles in the main to kind of dominate proceedings, then it would be really difficult to see another outcome other than a kind of swift or a kind of short road to victory for Russia. But I mean, as we've seen in the last 3 months, that couldn't have been any further from the reality on the ground. And so I think certainly when it comes to air power and so forth, you know, that asymmetric advantage that Russia has, you know, you're talking over 330 aircraft in its inventory, and, you know, far superior than what anything that Ukraine can claim. Sorry, that's on the kind of the fighter side. You know, you would have kind of sense or, you know, just going off the numbers would have told you, okay, this looks like Russia will make like kind of light work of all of this, but it hasn't happened. And there's, I mean, analysts or some are kind of scratching their head as to, you know, big picture why this happened, or, you know, what they missed in kind of their early analysis. I mean, I have heard that one kind of assumption that was made would be that if, you know, if you gave the aircraft that Russia have, if you put that in the hands of the US and the UK, just as an example, they would make much more effective use. And that's really down to the complex training scenarios that they run through, you know, having 9, 10, 11 aircraft on operations at once, which simply hasn't really been the case here for Russia. They've been, you know, 1, 2, 3 three aircraft operations fairly consistently. And so that's really... hamstrung their operations and really made life a lot more difficult than it might otherwise. But also I think that there's been a real question mark, certainly when it comes to rotary wing as well, when it comes to the Soviet era helicopters that Russia are relying on, so Ka-52s, the Mi-17s, the Mi-24s, in particular, whether their countermeasures have been up to scratch, you know, whether they've even been given the kind of urgency with which they've had to conduct operations, you know, whether the personnel and our crew were prepped in time and flying with countermeasures even. I know that's been raised, for example, by Justin Bronk, the academic at RUSI. And so, you know, when it comes to, when you tie that in as well, you know, you've got to consider that's certainly has been of kind of major consequence, because in particular we've seen kind of consistent shootdowns of Russian helicopters also engaged at short range, and, you know, without kind of very little notice. And so a kind of one industry source mentioned to me that in terms of, you know, that whole scenario and kind of making sense of it, there's a number of things that might have happened in terms of kind of the countermeasures, either that kind of the FLIRs had already been expended earlier in a flight, missile warning radar, you know, didn't identify the threat correctly, or the system was broken, or the pilot didn't see the missile launch, or, you know, didn't have enough time to action the FLIR. And so, yes, I'm kind of given a kind of a wide kind of, let's call it just a wide summary of, you know, how countermeasures work and the difficulties that might have gone alongside that. But also when you think of the amount of weapons that are being supplied, certainly the anti-aircraft weapons that are being supplied by the UK and by the US, you know, Stinger, NLAW, and things like that, and man pads, of course, there may well have also been just more advanced man pads that Russia, you know, didn't see coming, you know, more used to the kind of the older technology and the older man pads, and just suspected that you know, that they would be able to cope fairly easily with those types of things. But yeah, certainly kind of over the last number of months, that would kind of be the my main reading of things and why the Russia hasn't really had an easy time of things. And now, as you kind of rightly pointed out, we're into an attritional state of affairs now.
It's interesting that you talk about, mention the fact that Russian training may have been deficient, or Russian operational doctrine might have been deficient in the Ukrainian operation. As the Ukrainians use many of the same platforms as the Russians, is there a noticeable difference in the way that the Ukrainian, for instance, Ukrainian helicopter pilots, is there a noticeable difference in the way that they operate compared with the Russians?
Well, I think I would only have to, I would only be able to go off kind of the shoot down incidents to kind of suggest that probably there is a difference. But what in terms of differences in equipment and kind of how effective the Ukrainian resistance is, I suppose maybe the better way of addressing this might be kind of suggest that the US arms and the UK arms, and sorry, I should just say that your other European allies that have been sending weapons, all of the arms that are being supplied are very easy to train on. And that's probably the most significant point to make when it comes to Ukrainian resistance, certainly. And when, you know, when you think, I spoke to the US Army about the training for Switchblade. You know, there's over 700 of those loitering munitions that are either on their way to Ukraine or some of which have already been delivered. But you know, that's the program of instruction is 40 hours, and some US Army soldiers have had their certificate within 24 hours. You know, so that goes to show that it's very relatively straightforward to kind of use these weapons. So I think that's probably what I would say on that. I find it difficult to speak specifically on Ukrainian training, just because, you know, I haven't been in a position to talk to anyone on the front line or read of training, I should say as well.
And the Ukrainians themselves have been very careful. Well, their operational security has been quite tight in not wanting to divulge too much information about their tactics. So that's only understandable. We've talked a bit about the TB2, and you know, as you were the air editor, you can take a kind of informed view of the actual success of this platform, which, after all, the Ukrainians have been operating even before the conflict. So it's not a brand new system for them. But in the way that the TB2 has been applied on the battlefield, and also, as Tim, as Harry says, at sea as well, what have we learned about this particular platform that we didn't know before?
Well, it's thoroughly effective, and I suppose the jury was out in terms of, you know, whether it's able to function in a highly contested environment. But look, I think you've seen lots of video footage from the aircraft itself, whether that's from the Ukraine MOD showing the shootdown incidents and Snake Island, as you've mentioned as well, to kind of suggest that it's not just kind of propaganda on the part of Ukraine and to kind of gain public support to show these incidents. You know, it is, as perhaps the manufacturer has claimed it is, you know, highly effective and well capable of operating, despite, you know, the critique that it's not stealthy, so it wouldn't have any place in a highly contested environment. It's very much been a it's very much been a worthwhile investment on the Ukrainian side. And I think, you know, the demand and supply that actually we'd seen pre-invasion kind of speaks to the fact that customers are kind of cottoning on to just how important it is in these types of situations.
The Ukrainian Air Force has managed to remain a force to be reckoned with to some degree, managed to avoid being wiped out, as I'm sure the Russians wanted to do in the early stages of the conflict. But as we all know, there are regular calls for Western aircraft or Soviet-era aircraft in Eastern European NATO Air Force inventories to be transferred to Ukraine. That's a debate that is still a live issue to some degree, isn't it, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, in the early part, it was a lot of focus on MiG-29s, and because that they would be common to what the Ukraine Air Force are operating in. You know, whether Bulgaria and Poland, for example, could just easily transfer their aircraft and then have the US resupply them with alternatives. I've spoken to a few people about this, really to kind of get their perspective on, you know, whether it's realistic, whether it's doable, and, you know, what the pros and cons of it are. I think from the ex-pilot community, it's a simple case of even if they weren't MiG-29s, put them in a cockpit and they'll find a way to fly the thing within a week, within a week to 10 days. Now, look, that's, you know, maybe it's a bit macho, it's a bit of bravado on the part of fighter pilots, but, you know, balance that out and say, well, you know, if they've been doing it for, had been doing it for 10, 15 years, then, you know, you'd see no reason to doubt them. But I don't think, obviously, decisions are being made on that very basis, and, you know, you'd hope not. Certainly, I think it probably the greater issue for, obviously, the US have to approve of these things, but the greater problem is whether or not the transfer of fighter jets in particular is seen as a red line for Russia, because the whole argument is that Russia can stomach, so to speak, you know, some of the less lethal weapons being transferred. You know, of course, they don't like it, and, you know, they've said that they would target Poland, for example, because obviously they're flowing over Polish borders. But, you know, I think, you know, whether aircraft would be just too big of an issue, and in other words, it would escalate matters quite significantly, because that's effectively what Russia are saying. And I think, you know, without kind of putting too fine a point on it, I think probably that's where the US and the European allies have kind of agreed with, almost. And, well, you know, the truth of the matter is in the actions that they've taken, which is so far not to have any additional aircraft transferred to Ukraine, barring, I think, the US have sent MI-17s,
that's right.
You know, but obviously, yeah, they're rotary wing, they're not combat jets. And when you consider that what we're up to, is it, well, as of, I think, 10th of May, $4.5 billion worth of security assistance sent, and not one item has been a fighter jet. So, you know, I think that kind of that
tells a story.
Kind of speaks, yeah. it speaks to this, definitely.
You mentioned red lines, Tim, and it's an interesting point in that, as you and Harry both rightly said, the equipment that was supplied to Ukraine in the early stages and just before the war was so-called defensive armament, such as sort of short-range weaponry, anti-tank, and so forth. But there have been shipments of long-range artillery. Anti-ship missiles as well have been sent, as Harry mentioned. So I'd like to sort of ask both of you, are we now in the territory of mission creep as far as NATO assistance is concerned.
Yeah, so it's interesting you say that, Ben. I suppose the big question remains is kind of, as this is now 3 months into this conflict, and I suppose we've got what is kind of, like you've said, attritional warfare to an extent in eastern Ukraine, and kind of with the Russians having pulled out of northern Ukraine and kind of Ukrainian forces reaching the border in certain areas and reestablishing that. I suppose there will be a question as to at what point Ukraine decides to go on the offensive to recapture territory, and to what extent Ukraine decides it wants to do that. And then I suppose, based on those questions and what the Ukrainian government decide, will then pose a question for NATO as to how it continues to supply these stocks, and whether if the war goes from defensive in terms of Ukrainian in terms of Ukraine defending its territory to Ukraine looking to take land back, then it might become a slightly more difficult question for NATO and other countries, given that the previous kind of line in the sand has been these are weapons to help Ukraine defend its territory from a threat. So that's my thought.
And Tim?
Yeah, I suppose, and added to that, you know, what additional resources can be easily come by for the US, for Europe, you know, without there being a production question mark over, you know, these high end items take a lot longer to manufacture than, you know, just than kind of Enlaw and the things that have already changed hands. You know, you're into kind of certainly for fighter jets, you're looking at, you know, 18 months to 2 years production, you know, even lead times are longer than that and so forth. And then, of course, back, you know, we're going out in circles here, but then you're back to, okay, what are the common aircraft to that Ukraine has, unless you want to kind of look at difficulties around training, or, you know, look at, you know, it taken several months rather than weeks to kind of train fleets on these types of things.
There are problems for the Western defence industry, aren't there? Because there are, or there were, for example, sufficient stocks of Javelin and Stinger in the US to send Ukraine thousands of systems to use in defense against a Russian invasion. But to take the example of Javelin and Stinger, the US now faces a problem in needing to, in some cases, restart production of systems that had been suspended or taken out of production.
Yeah, on the switchblade side, that's absolutely a real problem that's facing the US DOD, and I would say kind of sooner rather than later. So I was speaking with AeroVironment's CEO, Wahid Nawabi, and he was kind of pointing out that, you know, beyond the kind of 700 that we know about, the 700 loitering munitions that are being sent, and I've just kind of previously mentioned, that are being sent to Ukraine, the US, by his calculation, have more than a thousand switchblade in their inventory, and he was saying that that's down to, as he put it, very low numbers at this point, and that's obviously in light of the transfers to Ukraine. And basically he was saying that there's a really big problem here for the DOD, in that for decades they've always had AeroVironment have always had to fulfill or operate under, you know, an urgent operational needs statement and not a program of record. And so there's that leads to kind of, let's just call it what it is, unpredictable production. And really what he was saying that in terms of needing a new requirement, a new contract, and why that matters for the US DOD is that unless AeroVironment receive a priority order, which is listed as DOA1 or DXA1 approved. And that's just a technical term for the processes that the US Department of Commerce and the US DOD use, which gives an order preferential treatment compared to a commercial order that has no priority rating. Effectively, he was saying that that's absolutely essential because he has a kind of an at-risk order under the kind of commercial policy rather than the DOA1 or DXA1 rating system. It means he has to kind of go to suppliers, but they can only commit to kind of small volumes. And so Eurovironment, for example, will say, on that basis, would sit behind when they're looking for electronics parts, when they're looking for video game equipment. And, you know, these parts are essential so that Switchblade can operate. When he goes to suppliers to place those orders, he's way down the list because those types of suppliers are committing to meeting, first off, the kind of commercial and huge volume sales from the likes of Microsoft and Sony. So it is a huge issue. And, you know, as he was kind of saying, the Pentagon have to move much faster in addressing this, because then you're going to be into a scenario where effectively it becomes an unsustainable business model for our environment. And particularly if there are going to be any more of the security assistance announcements, you know, that where you'll find the kind of hundreds of switchblades being transferred, then, and as he's pointed out, you know, there's only a low quantity held in the US inventory. So yeah, I think that's that kind of, I know it's only just one small example, but certainly on the air side, obviously Switchblade has been such a big item, and you know, it does sort of maybe as a microcosm paint a bigger picture that DOD is confronted by.
And also, as I mentioned, the Javelin and Stinger issue has been relatively hotly debated by senators and congressmen in order to sort of make sure that US stocks of those weapons are maintained. And that does have an effect on industrial capacity on the part of the manufacturers, for instance, Raytheon and Lockheed Martin for Javelin. So it's very much an issue, and it's definitely one that I'm sure we'll be keeping an eye on. Thank you very much indeed, Tim, and thank you also, Harry, for joining us today. That wraps things up for what I hope you found is an interesting discussion. For our listeners, if you want to find out more about our defence news and analysis, please visit our website, www.shepherdmedia.com/news. The Shepherd Defence podcast was brought to you by Shepherd Studio, featuring myself, Ben Vogel, Harry Lai, and Tim Martin. Stay tuned for our next episode in June. But that's all from us for now. Goodbye.